The people who were most kind in getting out of his way, letting him pass, were those most apt to reach out to him, touch his clothes as he passed. "I want to say good night to the dog," Mooney said to Fletch. "Dog?" "The black dog." Again, when they were in the less congested bar area, Mooney said, "I really would like to say good night to that dog." "I don't see a dog, Mr. Mooney."
"Big black dog," Mooney said. "Name of emperor."
Fletch looked around.
"I don't see any dog, Mr. Mooney."
"He's on the other side of the bar," Mooney said.
"Why don't we go this way? It's quicker."
"All right."
He smiled wonderfully at Fletch.
"I've given that lecture 10,000 times," he said. "Know it as well as the ravings of Richard III. It's all nonsense, of course."
At the entrance to the alley, Mooney looked back into the bar.
"A clean, well-lighted place," he said.
Chapter 24. The phone rang, and Fletch was off the bed and across the room answering it before he really knew what he was doing. "Hello?"
"Fletch?"
It was Martin Satterley, ready to dispense information.
"Good morning, Martin."
Fletch sat in the chair next to the telephone table.
"What time is it in New York?"
Through the windows to the balcony, first light was in the sky.
5:15 a.m.
"Then it must be here, too."
Moxie was not in his bed. She had chosen to spend the night in a hammock on the balcony.
"Find anything?"
"Not as much as we could have found if we hadn't been interrupted. An hour ago, the authorities swooped into Peterman's office, where we were working, and laid claim to all Ms. Mooney's financial records. Asked us politely but firmly to leave."
"They were quick. Did you show them Moxie's authorization?"
"Of course. It was not my scheme to be thought a burglar in the night. They had papers from a higher authority."
"Their piece of paper beat your piece of paper, huh?"
"Their piece of paper was signed by a judge. My piece of paper was signed by a movie star."
"So you're going to tell me everything is all right and Moxie was just having a bad dream about all this.
Does Yellow Orchid mean anything to you as a film title?"
"No."
"In Ramon's Bed?"
"No."
20 Minutes to 12?
"No, don't think so."
"Midsummer Night's Madness?"
"Of course, that's the film Moxie is making now."
"Are they actually making it?"
"I'm not sure they have been."
"Sculpture Garden?"
"No."
"These are all films supposedly being made, I should say financed, by Jumping Cow Productions."
"Yes, all right."
"The sole proprietor of Jumping Cow Productions is Ms. Marilyn Mooney."
"Holy cow."
"Chief executive officer and treasurer is, or was, Stephen Peterman."
"Wave that in front of me again, Marty. Moxie owns Jumping Cow Productions?"
100%.
"I know she doesn't know that. She keeps referring to Jumping Cow as them and they. In fact, I think she's been waiting word from someone at Jumping Cow as to whether filming on Midsummer Night's Madness is to continue."
"She's waiting to hear from herself."
"Wow."
"You can say she didn't know about it, Fletch, but her signature is in all the appropriate places. The Delaware incorporation papers, loan agreements."
"Talk to me about the loan agreements, Marty."
"I wish I could tell you everything. I can't. Cops interrupt us. We were able to discover there are huge sums of money floating around for no reason we were able to discover. Millions of dollars. Some of the money seemed to have been raised to produce these films, but we can't find any evidence that any of these films exist in any form whatsoever, except Midsummer Night's Madness, which, by the way, seems to have a remarkably low budget. There are loans from Swiss banks and Colombian banks and Bolivian banks. Some of these loans seem to have been used to repay loans to banks in Honduras, Mexico, and Bahamas. Thoroughly confusing. On some loans, we couldn't find schedules of repayment, or that anything at all had been repaid. On other loans, which were being repaid, we couldn't find the pieces of paper which said the loans had actually been taken out in the first place."
Fletch had drawn his knees up and put his feet in the chair. He was warmer that way.
All this under the banner of Jumping Cow Productions?
No. A huge, huge amount of this activity is under her own name, personally.
That's bad.
I think so.
Marty, how would you say she stands in general financially, ahead or behind?
Haven't you been listening?
Tons of money which exist on paper under her name and under Jumping Cow Productions Incorporated don't seem to be anywhere.
Stolen.
Disappeared.
Then, financially, she is behind.
I'd say so. If you were looking for a motive for murder, you found one. A big one.
I wasn't, actually.
I can't see how she can ever get out of trouble, no matter how young she is. Millions are missing. Of course, maybe if we had another 3 weeks with the books, we could find some of it.
Can't she claim bankruptcy?
It's not just money I'm talking about, Fletch. A lot of baffling financial activity has been happening under her name. Again, I wasn't able to spend enough time with her financial records to use the word fraud advisedly.
Ow.
And her tax filings have been negligent. I mean negligible. Negligent and negligible. Minimum filings, maximum extensions. There were IRS pieces of paper among her records, but no real reportings of income, outgo, profit, loss.
Jail?
Well, for next year she shouldn't plan too big a New Year's Eve party.
But she wasn't doing all that bad stuff. She didn't even know about it.
It was going on under her name, and she signed things.
Marty, what about her personal assets?
Well, she owns a cooperative apartment in New York, mortgaged to the maximum. Also a very expensive property in Malibu, California, also mortgaged to the maximum. Her ownership of common stock follows a very distinct pattern. She would purchase at $50 and $60 a share and sell at $12 and $16 a share.
Always?
Few exceptions.
Tax losses? Do you think Peterman was trying to create tax losses?
He was creating losses, all right. Huge losses. No preferred stock, no bonds. And the companies in which she invested were foreign companies no one ever heard of. I mean, like a chain of bakeries in Guatemala.
Must be dough in that.
A Mexican trucking company. A restaurant in Caracas, Venezuela.
Caramba.
An unrelieved tale of woe, Fletch. The only other thing she seems to own in this country is half interest in a horse farm in Ocala, Florida.
Oh.
That means something to you? Five Aces Farm?
Oh. Fletch counted his toes. The alleged owner of that farm, Ted Sills, was a friend of Peterman's. I guess. That is, I met Sills at a party at Moxie's apartment once in New York. Peterman introduced us.
Well, your friend Moxie has paid for the shipment of an awful lot of racehorses between here and Venezuela.
Oh. But Martin, Moxie didn't even recognize Ted Sills' name when I mentioned him yesterday. We're even staying in Ted Sills' house right now.
Small world.
Even I've invested in some of the son-of-a-bitch's racehorses.
Maybe I should go through your papers, too.
Maybe you should. Hell's bells, Marty. What does all this add up to?
I don't know. Wasn't able to spend that long with her papers. On the face of things, it looks like your Moxie Mooney had an excellent motive for killing Steve Peterman. The best. Not once, but several times.
That's what the police will say, isn't it?
I expect so. Of course, they could always find a factor which makes everything come out all right, but I doubt it. Experience has taught me, Fletch, that honest people do not bury their honesty in dishonest-seeming records.
Martin, is there some way all this shifting of money about, taking loans, losing money, could be thought to benefit Moxie?
I don't know.
I mean, isn't it pretty clear from the papers she's the victim here?
Martin Satterley thought a short moment. The presumption is, Fletch, that when a person goes in for sharp practices, he is doing so with some idea of personal benefit in mind.
But Marty, everything's such a mess.
People who go in for sharp practices usually make a mess. They usually lose. Losing, Fletch, is no evidence of virtue.
Oh.
I must also point out to you, seeing you sought my advice, the very real possibility that your friend Moxie Mooney is lying to you from start to finish. She'd have to be a pretty good liar. Isn't that what an actor is, a pretty good liar? Come on, Marty. Consider it as a very real possibility, Fletch. I'm not sitting in judgment of your friend. Sooner or later, someone will, I expect. Consider the possibility that she was in this financial razzle-dazzle with Steve Peterman, and that she murdered him only when she discovered she was being swindled, too. My early judgment would be, if I were making a judgment, that your friend Moxie Mooney is either awfully guilty or awfully stupid. She's just in trouble. And she knew it, right?
Why do you say that?
Why else would you have asked me to go look at Peterman's books?
Moxie the murderess is a concept I'm having difficulty wrapping my mind around.
Martin Satterley said, I'm pretty sure most people who commit murder have a friend somewhere.
Chapter 25. You don't look like you slept well, Moxie said. She was looking up at him from a hammock on the second story of the Blue House.
Up to a point, I did. Fletch had gone back to bed at 5:45, but he had not slept. He listened to the quiet house. He got out of bed again at 8:30, only because he heard the Lopezes coming into the house. He also heard the grinding gears and squeaking brakes of trucks and buses. In the hammock, Moxie stretched and yawned.
Thought we'd go sailing today, Fletch said. We can rent a catamaran on one of the beaches.
That would be nice. Somewhere in the house, a window smashed. In the street in front of the house, someone was yelling.
Stay here, Fletch said.
On the balcony, he walked around the corner to the front of the house. Jerry and Stella Littleford were already there. They were looking out onto the street. As Fletch approached, they looked at him. On their faces were shock, confusion, anger, hurt, amazement. They said nothing. In the street in front of the Blue House were two old rickety yellow school buses, three trucks big enough to carry cattle, a few vans, and some old cars. On the sides of the yellow school buses in big black letters was written, Save America. People from these vehicles were milling in the street, and some of these people wore white hooded robes with eye and nose holes cut in their faces. And others wore brown shirts and brown riding breeches and black jack boots and black neckties and black armbands with red swastikas on them. And some of these people were women in cheap house dresses, and some were children.
Look at the children, Stella said.
Some men were passing demonstration signs down from the trucks. The signs were passed along from hand to hand. The signs said, Keep America white, Hollywood sells U.S. soul, no racial mix. One sign, carefully hand-printed, read, No mongrelization. And these signs came to be held by the men in white hooded robes, and by the women, and by the children.
I guess they mean me, Jerry Littleford said.
No, Stella Littleford said. They mean me. To the left, the 30 neo-Nazis were trying to appear military. A man with a red band around his hat was yelling at them as they were lining up. They all had beer bellies they were sucking in while tucking their chins in to show they all had dewlaps. Moxie was standing beside Fletch, and she put her hand on his on the railing.
These people must have driven all night, Fletch said.
These aren't people, Moxie said.
In the street, someone said, There's Moxie Mooney and cunt, whore, were shouted in both men's and women's voices, and a voice said, Isn't that old Jerry Littleford up there?
And a rock bounced off the wall of the house behind where they were standing and fell to the floor near their feet. From one of the trucks, My Country Tis of Thee began to blare. Fletch said to Moxie,
You don't think people care about such things anymore?
You think there came a moment in history when everyone wised up and love and understanding pervaded the world? Well, it hasn't happened yet, babe. Maybe on television, but not in real life.
Moxie said, The sick, the stupid, and the scared.
With two rows of uniformed plodgies standing behind him, the man distinguished by a red band around his hat began to shout a speech over the sound of music.
We all know what this is about. We all know what is happening. We all know what is happening to the world. Who runs Hollywood, which makes the movies? The Jews. Who runs the newspapers, which sell the movies? The Jews. Who owns the movie theaters, which show the movies? The Jews. Who owns the television networks, which push the movies into our homes, spoiling the minds of our children? The Jews. And who pays the Jews? The communists. The Jewish people do not mix. Oh, no. They do not marry outside their race. They marry outside their race and their families say they're dead. The Russians do not marry outside their race. Oh, no, they send the Jews out of their country.
Moxie giggled. This is getting confusing. Along Duval Street, from the houses, guest houses and coffee shops, and from the side streets, ordinary citizens began to appear. They stood apart from these others, their eyes wide, their mouths open. They spoke to each other in disbelief. A large number of them were gathering. A woman shrieked, "Be nice!" The fishermen began to appear in the crowd, the real fishermen and the sport fishermen, and even the other kind of fishermen who always came back to Key West with a full cargo of shrimp they had bought with their other, more valuable cargo. Fletch recognized two or three people who had been at Dirty Harry's the night before, listening to Frederick Mooney. A Cuban-American boy, a conch, about 8 or 10 years old, sat cross-legged on the ground behind a man in a white robe. Fletch watched the boy take a cigarette lighter from the pocket of his shorts. It took him 5 or 6 tries to get flame from the lighter. Then he set fire to the hem of the man's robe. "Land of Liberty!" The man jumped, beat his burning robe with his arm, and kicked the kid hard, rolling him over in the gutter. He kicked the kid again in the head. By then, the robe was burning well. A woman was trying to grab the robe off him. He kept kicking the kid. The crowd rushed the people who had driven all night. Rocks went through the air in all directions. Sticks appeared from nowhere. Here and there, on bare skin and on the white robes, red blood began to appear. Women were screaming in Cuban and English. The man distinguished by the red band around his hat ordered his uniformed plodgies to drive a wedge through all these screaming, hitting, kicking, yelling people, and the uniformed plodgies went into the fray. They were beaten nicely. From the center of Key West, finally there came the sounds of sirens. Fletch took Moxie's elbow. "Let's go." "Where are we going?" "Sailing," Fletch said. "It's a nice day for sailing." Edith Howell, in her dressing gown, was carrying a cup of coffee up the main stairs of the Blue House. "Something I've never understood," she said to Moxie and Fletch, "is how one can be a Jew and a communist at the same time. A tree and a stone cannot be the same thing. Either one is one thing or one is another." "Sick people," Moxie answered. Lopez was sitting in the front hall. He wore a clean white jacket. He said, "Mr. Fletcher, Mr. Sills is on the phone. He says if I don't put you on the phone, he fires me." Cy Collar came out of the dining room with his cup of coffee. He said to Moxie, "We're a part of an international conspiracy?" "Throw him a script, Cy," Moxie answered. "Let him see how bad it is." Collar said, "I'd suspect Peterman's hand behind this business, you know, for publicity, if he weren't dead." Fletch said to Lopez, "Did you tell Sills what's going on outside?" Outside were the sounds of sirens and hysterical screaming. "No," said Lopez. Fletch went down the corridor and through the billiard room to the study. He lifted the telephone receiver from the desk. "Good morning, Ted," Fletch said into the phone. "Nice day. We're just going sailing." "Why am I hearing sirens?"
"Sirens?"
Ted Sills said. "I'm hearing sirens over the phone while I've been waiting. Was someone singing 'My Country, 'Tis of Thee'?"
"I wasn't, not this morning."
"I heard people screaming. I'm still hearing people screaming."
"Must be a bad connection."
"What's going on there, Fletch?"
"Just settling down for breakfast. Maybe you heard Edith Howell practicing on the scales."
Somewhere in the house, another pane of glass smashed.
"What was that?" Ted Sills asked over the phone.
"What was what?"
"Sharp noise. Sounded like glass breaking."
Must have been at your end, Ted."
"Sounds like a riot's going on."
"Must be your telephone cord, Ted. Give it a tug and see if it clears up."
"Fletcher, I've told you and your little playmates to get out of that house."
"Yes, you did, Ted."
"You're still there."
"Having a few days of peace and quiet."
"I heard on the morning news you're still there, in the Blue House."
Oh, that reminds me, Ted. When does the rubbish get picked up? Want to make sure Lopez puts it out.
I want you to get out of the goddamned house, Ted Sills shouted.
Now, Ted, no wonder your phone is broken.
All right, Fletcher, I'm coming down there with a shotgun. And if you're not out of that house by the time I get there...
You'll hardly be noticed. By the way, Ted, you never told me Moxie Mooney is half-owner of Five Aces Farm.
There was silence from Ted Sills' end of the line. From Fletcher's, there were three sounds which could have been light-caliber gunshots.
I happened to find out just this morning, Fletch said. I didn't know you two knew each other.
Ted Sills said, Ms. Mooney has a financial interest in this farm. What's that to you?
Nothing. Just think it odd that here you have two such nice financial partners, Moxie and me, staying in your resort house, and you want us out.
Fletcher, Ted Sills sighed. You don't know what you're doing. You've turned that house into a circus.
Not me, Ted.
Moxie appeared in the doorway of the study. Her eyes were huge.
Stella Littleford's been hurt, she said.
Sorry, Ted, Fletch said into the phone. Gotta go.
What did I just hear? Sills shouted. Who's been hurt?
The 3-minute eggs, said Fletch. Their feelings are hurt. I'm not there eating them. He hung up and followed Moxie into the front of the house. Stella Littleford was sitting like a dropped doll on the floor of the front hall. Her hands were over her forehead. Blood was seeping through her fingers. Cy Collar was kneeling beside her.
Definite need for stitches, he said to Fletch.
The front door was open. A low haze of riot gas drifted over the street. Police had set up sawhorse barricades in a U in the street at the front of the Blue House. Two were knocked over. There were a few discarded white robes on the road. It was also one of the uniformed plodgies sitting on the road in a position nearly identical to Stella Littleford's, another dropped doll, also holding his head. To the right, down Duval Street, away from the riot gas, hand-to-hand fighting and mouth-to-mouth shouting was continuing. Directly across the street, a sinewy armed fisherman was puncturing the tires of the school buses and trucks with his fishing knife. Jerry Littleford ran into the yard, followed by two young men with a stretcher. His eyes were red and runny from the gas.
Shit forever, he said to Fletch.
He pointed to a broken rum bottle on the front porch.
Someone pegged Stella with that. Cut her head.
Clearly, there had still been rum in the bottle when it broke. The shattered glass was in a puddle. An ambulance was backing down the street over one of the fallen sawhorses to the front door of the Blue House. In the front hall, Mrs. Lopez was handing wet cloths to Moxie, who was handing them to Cy Collar, who was applying them to Stella Littleford's forehead. The young men who brought the stretcher stopped all that. They put a pile of dry gauze against the cut and taped it lightly. They helped Stella onto the stretcher.
Want me to go to the hospital with you? Fletch asked Jerry.
I do not.
Want Cy to go?
Jerry said, I do not.
Okay, Fletch said, I'll see you later.
Jerry followed the stretcher-bearers through the front door. Fletch stood on the front porch watching them put Stella into the back of the ambulance. When Moxie joined him, he said, Watch your feet, broken glass. The riot gas was dissipating. A swinging, kicking crowd came back down Duval Street from the right, knocking over another barricade. Fletch supposed the demonstrators were trying to get back to their buses and trucks. Their signs were broken and trampled around the trucks, as were a record player and the amplifiers. The trucks, the buses, and some of the cars had flat tires. But by then there were too many personal angers and personal scores to settle, and the pushing and the punching continued. From above their heads, from the upper front balcony of the Blue House, boomed the world's best-trained, most voluminous voice.
47 years ago!
Oh, God, said Moxie. In fact, the people in the street did look up. That's Frederick Mooney. And they did stop fighting.
Our forefathers brought forth on this continent.
Good old Freddy, said Fletch. Let's go sailing.
A new nation.
Fletch and Moxie walked through the house to the back. Even in the backyard, they could hear Mooney's Gettysburg Address. All other noises had ceased.
Think of that volume of sound, Moxie said. coming out of a head that must hurt as much as his does. Chapter 26. After they sailed a while, Moxie said, I suppose I should ask you, seeing it wasn't so long ago you put me on an airplane ostensibly for dinner and landed me far enough away from the scene of the crime to make me a fugitive from justice, if now you have me in a sailboat, do you mean to flee the country with me? Damn, said Fletch at the tiller. You caught me. You penetrated my purposeful plot. Moxie's eyes were full of the sunlight reflected from the sea. I've always heard Cuba is a gorgeous country. Up to that point, they had said little to each other. They had walked to a Cuban-American restaurant and had a quiet breakfast. Some of the people there had recognized Moxie and smiled at her in a friendly way and kept their dignity by otherwise leaving her alone. During breakfast, Moxie wondered aloud if Stella Littleford would have a scar on her forehead forever, and Fletch said he thought Stella had suffered a concussion as well because there'd been quite a lot of rum in the bottle that had hit her. The senora of that restaurant made a picnic lunch for them and put it in a cardboard box. Fletch also bought a six-pack of cold soft drinks. They walked the long way around, along the water, until they came to a beach where Fletch rented a catamaran. He put the food and the drinks aboard. Boys on the beach helped them push the catamaran into the surf. Fletch boosted Moxie aboard and then climbed aboard himself. The process of launching put enough water in the bottom of the boat to soak the cardboard picnic box. Moxie showed Fletch the soggy box as he was finding the wind and beginning to sail on it, and they laughed. She rescued the sandwiches and the fruit and rolled the box into a ball and dropped it into the bottom of the boat. Moxie was wearing her bikini, and she removed the top, but she kept herself more or less in the shade of the sail. She said, Talk to me. About what? Something nice, please. Edith Howell says if you're not talking, you're dead or something. If Edith Howell ever stopped talking, everyone else would die of shock. She has her eyes on your father's millions. Moxie snorted. Millions of empty cognac bottles. She's welcome to him. She put herself on her side and trailed her fingers in the water. Talk to me about something nice. Like how come you're so rich? You're asking me if I'm rich? Well, you're not working. You have that nice place in Italy. That's sort of a rude question from a girl I just met. I know. Answer me anyway. It's a long story. I've got all day. It's sort of an impossible story to tell in detail. Did you do something wrong, Fletch? Are you a crook? Who, me? No, I don't think so. What happened? Not much. One night I found myself alone in a room with a lot of cash. The cash was there because I'd been hired to do a bad thing. I had not done the bad thing, but the bad thing had happened anyway, coincidentally. Boy, why don't you spare me a few details? I told you it's a long story. So you took the money? I had to. Leaving it there would have embarrassed people. It would have raised questions. Robbery is an act of kindness? I thought so at the time. What did you do with the money? I didn't know what to do with it. I'd never been very good with money. No fooling. I remember the time... What time? Forget it, I'm still mad. There should never be money between friends.